All right, welcome to the Stand Up for Kids podcast. I'm your host, Mike Olson. I'm the Director of Development with Stand Up for Kids Orange County. And today's guest is Carlia Oldfather. She's a Director of Operations with Stand Up for Kids. And today we are going to tackle the question of why does youth homelessness exist? It's a question that is not an easy one, right? And it's got a lot of roots to it and causes that we're going to explore a little bit with Carlia, who's been with Stand Up for Kids for quite a while, and we're going to hear a little bit more about her. Look forward to talking to her. So welcome, Carlia.
Hi, how are you?
Carlia, why don't you start us off and just tell us a little bit about yourself and your position with Stand Up for Kids.
I've been with Stand Up for 4 years. I think my journey started my last internship. I was finished my bachelor's in human services. And I've been, you know, I started as an intern, and I just continued to work with the organization until now, where I'm a director of operations.
She's a person who's on the ground dealing with the issue on a daily, weekly, monthly basis. So let's
talk about youth homelessness. Why does youth homelessness exist? I think, and again, this is my personal opinion based on my experience. So that's a disclaimer. You know, when I think about youth homelessness, I think about family unit. I think about, you know, in every scenario, in every story that I've heard that our youth have told us, it starts on a breakdown in the family unit somehow. It could be because of, you know, substance abuse from the parents to sexual abuse. It's just a break in the family unit. And I think that's where we're really going to be able to end youth homelessness. We have to tackle the family unit. I think that's where the biggest challenge is.
Sure.
I mean, our kids are discarded because of their, you know, sexual orientation. They're discarded because they're not what the expectation is for the parents. Maybe kids are having kids and they don't have the knowledge or the grit or the support that it's needed, right? And a family is not only one person. It's not even if it's a single mother. When the single mother tells you that they've done it alone, they have not, right? There was somebody there in their lives. There was a friend on the phone when she was broken down, when she couldn't feed her kid, right? So there's always somebody.
Village raises a child, right?
It really does.
So what you're telling me, though, is something that sounds really difficult to try to tackle. How does an organization who, you know, is not a family member of this person, how do we help, or how do we?
So of course, you know, because of the situation, we're actually catching the youth in crisis, right? We do, as you know, we do preventive work. So we work with, you know, McKinney-Vento youth from different school districts under the age of 18. But it's still providing a support after the fact, right? So even in the youth that we're working with, we do preventive work with, right? We're preventing their youth homelessness by showing them that there's a support system for them, which is us, right? Mentors, volunteers, everybody, every single one of us plays a part, right, in how that looks like. And that's how we do it. But notice how we're not in the family unit,
right?
Still, right? We're still working with the youth. So I think for the underage youth, I think we would have to expand to supporting the family to truly see a critical change in their situation.
Yeah, so you're touching on two, there's, you know, the way I always tell it is that we have two different populations within our 12 to 24 age range. We have what I always call them the at-risk population, which is the 12 to 18 school age population, and then the crisis population, which is the 18 to 24 population. And the at-risk, like you're saying, we're getting in much earlier, at least.
Yes.
And to your point, is it early enough? Is it what is needed? It definitely is on some level. But the crisis youth they're just so much further along in the, I don't want to say the word damage, but they've just had so many more years of bad
pain
and pain. So then to pull them back or, support them, it's a much more difficult process when they've accumulated so many years of pain. So mm-hmm. going back to the 12 to 18 youth to, try to get a jump on that seems like definitely the easier path.
And we've been successful in that. I mean, we have a lot of youth that have started with us in seventh grade and they've been with us. We've seen them graduate high school, right? And to this day, even if they're not in crisis themselves as adults, as young adults, they'll reach out to us and check in. Or if they need help with a new job and they want some pointers, they'll reach out to their mentors for that. And that's very critical because we're creating that safety net, right? Since they're 12. I mean,
yeah, they know they have us. So I was on a call last week and I'm going to butcher the quote, but it's basically one adult can really change the life of a kid. Was the gist of it.
There's a lot of studies on natural mentors and that would be our volunteers, for example, right? So I as a mentor, I'm not a natural mentor. I went to school. I'm plugging myself into the lives of the kids. A natural mentor is like our volunteers. Like when we connect our youth to their volunteer mentor, right? They don't have a background. Maybe they do. I'm just saying, but we're not looking for a bachelor, or mentorship. You know what I mean? We're just looking for people with experiences and care and love and willingness to guide, right? And to provide that village support that we just talked about, right?
Yeah. And it's, I don't want to sell us short, and I've said this to people before too, but it's not rocket science on some level. Like
it really isn't.
Adult that is there to listen. And I use myself in a lot of these conversations because I had two parents that were there and mostly listened and mostly, supported me. And if I didn't have those people, like, where would I be? Like I was up, like as a kid, I was off the rails in high school. Like I did a lot of stupid stuff. With two parents that were looking after me, that were checking on my grades, that were feeding me and clothing me and making sure I got Christmas presents and all of those types of things. So take me and take away a parent or take away both parents or add physical abuse or verbal abuse or anything else. And I could easily have went a very different direction. And
absolutely.
But I could be in jail right now for all I know. So I try to, I try to think about that. I try to step back as often as I can and think about how, grateful that I am to have the upbringing that I had. And when you see kids that just don't have a family structure and they're figuring it out on the fly on a day-to-day basis, then it really kind of brings it home what I have to have. And that's part of the reason why I work for Stand Up for Kids is to hopefully reach out and, give an olive branch to kids that are in a rough spot. Felt a lot of pain. And
another layer, a lot of people think that our kids choose to be on the streets and they, and yes, they had to run away. Yes. Some of them are using to numb themselves so they don't, because they don't want to be left alone with their thoughts, right? So you medicate, you self-medicate, right?
Yeah.
But it's not a choice.
Yeah.
It's not a choice.
The root of self-medication is not, hey, I'm just a goofy teenager who wants to get high. It's no,
right.
I'm masking something or, there's some root cause to it that's much deeper.
Yeah.
And it's probably related to the family structure or breakdown or.
I think so.
Along those lines. Do you know?
And it's so easy. It's so easy to lose track as a parent. Right? I have four kids. It's so hard to, it's so easy to lose track. And I don't even know how some of these kids have survived this long.
Yeah. So you've been with Stand Up For Kids for about 4 years. I mean, you've probably been in contact with hundreds of youth ages 12 to 24. Is there a common thread that runs through these kids that you see?
For the ones, the at-risk ones, right? I would have to say being heard. That's like a common denominator. They don't feel heard. They don't feel there's anybody there truly listening and paying attention, right?
And supporting them and...
Right, because it's, I mean, you can make sure there's food in the house, right? And yeah. You can make sure that there's a house and there's all these, you know, basic needs met. It doesn't really mean that you're listening
to
your child.
And where does that, so if I'm a child and I'm not being listened to, where does that lead me or what is that? What is the result?
Well, hopefully you know of us and it leads you to our centers, right? So that you can get what you're missing. And because if you look, like, for example, and again, talking about at-risk kids, right? You have gang violence, right? You have gang. What is it that makes the youth want to join a gang? Think about it.
Yeah.
Belonging. Somebody listening to me, actually making me feel that I matter, that I'm part of something bigger, right? If a kid is in a household where they don't play a part in that family unit, they're just there. They have no decision making. They just literally go around life doing what they're told or not doing it and getting in trouble, either or, right?
Yeah.
So how is that? How can we expect that? And then that's another thing with the 18 to 24, the automatic download of information that we expect them to have when they turn 18 and they're supposed to understand budgeting and understand credit and understand how to, you know, clean a household and how to cook and, you know, doesn't exist. They're the same 17 year old they were the night before, but yet we're kicking them out on the streets because they should act like adults and, you know, pave their own way. It's very disheartening. It's very disheartening.
Let's go back to the, so if I'm in the at-risk, I'm in high school and my parents aren't listening to me. Debunk this a little bit. Like, I feel like there's a lot of kids whose parents don't really listen to them and do kind of what you said.
A whole lot. Yep.
And I don't know. And I wasn't in a gang. I don't know anything about gangs. I didn't live in a neighborhood that had a lot of gangs, but I had a lot
That's another one. That's another one.
What's that?
Location where you live has something.
I guess that's what I want to explore a little bit. So I felt like there are definitely times in my growing up where I didn't feel like I was really listened to and my parents didn't get me and whatever, but that didn't lead me to go get in a gang. I just kind of dealt with it.
How did you deal with it? Do you remember?
Not really. I went and hung out with my friends and I told them my problems, I guess. And
well, there you go. You started with friends, right?
Yeah.
So who were your friends?
Yeah, they're the kids I went to school with. And
right?
Yeah.
So that could be a layer of reasoning on why, right? The friends that
I landed
in. A factor, correct. That's a factor.
Yeah.
Having trauma, right? That's why you get the ACEs, the adverse childhood experiences.
Yeah. Why don't you explain that? What is ACEs and why does it matter?
So I don't remember the details on Kaiser Permanente developing. Well, they caught it from somebody else that was doing some research on the impact of trauma or adverse childhood experiences, right, as ACEs stands for, mm-hmm. Before your 18th birthday, and how that impacts your adult self. How what happened to you before your 18th birthday directly impacts your adult self. So, and there's a lot of stats that talks about a higher risk of substance abuse, higher risk. I mean, and when we do this officially, I can have that up, you know what I mean? So that if this is what we want to do, to really hone into that, because they're really mind blowing, those statistics. And yeah. So, mm-hmm.
And basically it's a questionnaire.
It's 10 questions.
10 questions.
And they're very crude. You know, they talk about, were you molested, you know, sexually by somebody that was five years older than you? And it tells you, you know, it goes a little bit into detail on what that may look like, right? Yeah. It talks about, did somebody go to prison when, you know, before your 18th birthday? So I think it's categorizing exposures to trauma. There's some domestic violence questionnaires there where they ask, did you see your parent or grandparent be hit, you know, punched, smacked, and so forth and so on. So believe it or not, so this questionnaire, it truly helps us really gauge if our youth, the young adults, right, are going to need mental health services. But it's these are things that you cannot change. If you got raped, you can't change that, right? If you were told since you were born that you are nothing, that you're a waste of time, right? And that self-talk can be so damaging. Even for somebody like you, for example, right? That didn't experience these, you know, most of these challenges, right? Mm-hmm. Even you can think about how is that going to impact you, right?
Totally. Yeah. I mean, so if I'm taking, I took the ACEs and I think I was a one or a two. I think I was a two, which is relatively low, right? Like,
yeah. It is pretty low. Four is when we recommend to our youth to mental health services.
But yeah, so I guess like for a person who doesn't really understand, like, you know, or may have the opinion like, hey, they're homeless because they want to be, because they like the freedom, or because XYZ.
I've seen the cases, Mike. I've seen the kids that you would say that about. Like if you meet them, you say, nah. But when we get to know them a little bit deeper, when we do the intake and do the needs assessments and ask the real deep questions, right, to truly assess what the needs are of that youth, it's scary.
You know, some kid on the street that you run into, he's not going to tell you his life story. He's not going to tell you how and the why and the...
No, he's tough. He's tough and he doesn't need you.
Yeah. You're going to get his skeptical self who's used to getting treated like garbage for many, many years and you know, is afraid of adults because he's been, he's had countless experiences where he knows now that he can not trust an adult figure. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, you know, it's...
And those are the hardest ones to, you know, to really reach.
Yeah.
Our program is based on results, right? Our program is based on going through the stages, right? And becoming self-sufficient and making sure they hit some milestones, right? Mm-hmm. So that they can become self-sufficient and learn that. And when we work with youth that have experienced so much trauma, mentoring, and you know this, you've seen it too in the office, you know, we've had youth that due to mental health reasons, they're stuck. They get stuck. And so our work shifts from trying to teach you how to become self-sufficient and equip you and give you the tools that you need and the support that you need, to how do we convince this youth to get to sit in front, or, you know, right now with COVID, you know, on their phone, right, and have a virtual, you know, mental health session? Like, how do we get them to therapy? Because we know, until that happens, nothing that we do is going to move that needle. And those are the ones that we lose. And those are the ones that we lose, the ones that we can't convince, because we can't make them, right? It's about convincing and trying to get to a place in the mentor-mentee relationship where they trust you enough, where if you say, hey, this might be, you know, a good thing to do, that they feel that they can trust the process because you're the one saying it.
Yeah. And I think that's one of the spots where Standing for Kids really differentiates ourselves versus some other agencies, where love and care and mentoring are really, like, that's our sweet spot. That's what we are really there to do, is build that relationship with that kid, which then unlocks the door to their potential and their growth and that trusting relationship with a caring adult. Mm-hmm. So I want to go back, though, to the, we were talking about families and how in the at-risk area, we're, you know, 12 to 18, 12 is our youngest age that we support. And so we have some middle school and high school programming, both in school and after school, where, again, the goal is to build that adult relationship.
That community, right? That village we talk about.
And build kind of an awareness to life. On a maybe a wider level or a deeper level than they may have been exposed to. But I want to get to that point about the family component and how you talked about, well, we're not in their family. So it's a little bit harder. We're kind of starting from behind, and we maybe need to integrate into the family a little bit more. And COVID, believe it or not, has been one of the drivers for us actually getting a little more involved with the parents. And maybe you can talk about the We Deliver program a little bit.
Yeah. So with that, we were very lucky that we, right before COVID hit, we received, MAPS, somebody from MAPS, Mothers Against Poverty, reached out to us and wanting to provide us with the freezer and with, you know, food, like real food, like meats and, you know, and by doing that, it allowed us, and it was just crazy because it happened like just before we couldn't be at the center anymore. So we couldn't feed our kids anymore, right? So this just kind of turned into, well, if we have this support from an organization like MAPS, then we can definitely provide that additional layer, not only to the youth, but to the family unit, right? Whatever that looks like for that specific youth. And again, this is more to the focusing on the at-risk kids who are accompanied, right? Mm-hmm. And these youth, we just put on our thinking hats pretty much and created this We Deliver program, where we are providing youth and their families with nutritional, valuable groceries and food on a weekly basis. And we're doing that not only with our families, but also with our young adults.
Yeah. And so we used to feed our kids. We fed our kids pre-COVID, but it ended up being more about at our mentoring nights, where we would have dinner and have a communal meal with the kids while we did the mentoring and our programming on those nights. And obviously with COVID, most all of the facilities that we did our programming out of got shut down, basically. Mm-hmm. And so there was a big shift to virtual mentoring, tutoring, interacting with our kids, because that's what we had to do as an organization. And so we had kind of a big pivot with COVID. And then one of the missing components there is the food and basic needs component that we used to provide through the mentoring nights. And so that's what Carly.
And another thing too, following up on that, at the center, for example, in Anaheim, which is where we serve 90% of our 12 to 24 year olds, right? I mean, 12 to 18 year olds, I apologize. So there they have a food pantry, right? So their families were taking advantage of the, you know, they had a little colonial market, right? So they have a little like food pantry for the families to come in and get food on a weekly basis. But with all this COVID that ended. So that's why I just wanted to reiterate that it's not that we weren't feeding the families. It's just that we didn't have to, right? They were receiving that support from our community partners, right?
Okay.
So it's not like we weren't supporting, but, you know, it was right there in the community center, right? So, or another organization was doing that. But for now, that was eliminated. There's no more market. There's no more, food pantry at the center because of COVID. So there was a huge loss. And a lot of the, you know, the single moms that, which our kids belong to, right? They were losing their jobs. We have, you know, immigration is another challenge, right? Some of our families are, immigrants as well, and they're not in legally, so they don't have the same ability to find employment. And usually that those jobs are odd jobs, which shouldn't happen during a pandemic, right? Because there's a lot of traction coming in now. You have the cleaning houses and
cool. So we've done a lot of exploration of the question, why does youth homelessness exist? One of the other, you know, and we also answered the question of, you know, I guess we explored the topic of, you know, do homeless kids really want to be homeless? And I think hopefully we've kind of summarized some of the logic and reasoning behind homelessness in Orange County. So our chapter and where we live is a very affluent area in the grand scheme of things. We're, I don't know, top 1% of the country on whatever our economy and things. Which is why
it's so hard to find them.
Yeah. So I guess the question is like, I mean, do we really have a problem in Orange County? And
what? Yeah, we have homeless kids in colleges. We have homeless kids in. You can ask the homeless liaisons of the school districts, see what they say.
Well, how come I don't see them? If I'm in LA and I go to Skid Row, or I go to Seattle, or I go to Chicago, or Houston.
Olympia, that was the, yes.
Yeah, so there's many places around the country that I can go and I can see homeless, and I understand the need, and I understand why an organization is trying to help fix that issue. In Orange County, it's not easy to see homeless people. They're off the freeways sometimes. They're generally not youth either that are typically seen. So can you color up that topic? Like, where are they? Where is the need?
So this is a very good question. And unfortunately, just because we don't see them piled up in the corner, it doesn't mean that they don't exist. Because this is, like you said, an affluent neighborhood, right? A lot of, you know, like a lot of youth would utilize our, and I'm not trying to say, to me, all youth are smart. You know, I'm not saying that the ones in Olympia are whatnot, okay? I'm not saying that. But here, for example, you can panhandle $10 easily, because people have money around here. So reaching 10 bucks is too easy. So what happens with $10? You can get a gym membership and you can take a shower. So now you're being resourceful, right? you don't stay on the same place all the time, because they're really strong. Like, they don't let you just hang out here. You can't just be homeless in a corner in Orange County. The police are going to be involved. Absolutely. So that eliminates that. That eliminates a whole bunch of people in a corner, right?
Yeah.
Right. So then we do have a lot of nonprofits in here in Orange County that provide different type of support. So kids know to go to SOS in Costa Mesa to get free clothing. So they don't have to wash clothing. So they grab it, they go to the gym, take a shower and change, and they have a clean clothes change right there. Right. So they are very resourceful. They know, they might crash in their cars. We have a lot of kids that just literally move their cars every night so that they can, you know, they don't get caught. When we did the pick count, where we counted the homeless in our community, those kids didn't want to be, you know, when we approached them, it wasn't, not all of them feel comfortable answering, more than an older person. I feel that the chronic homeless, the one that you think of, the pushing the cart, the old dude, right, or the old lady, maybe talking to themselves, they don't feel that there's, like, I feel that the youth don't want anybody to know that they're homeless, right?
Yeah, so shame.
Right. So they're not gonna look dirty, right? And you've seen our youth. They look like my kids. It's you know. So that's what happens when you're in an affluent community, that you have more opportunities to stay under the radar for longer.
Yeah. But at the end of the day, you're still homeless. You're still relying on that 10 bucks to get you that milkshake or that.
And guess what? If nobody's helping you and nobody teaches you how to adult,
you're going to live in that.
Guess what? That's where you're going to be. And that, so the work that we're doing right now with our 18-24 is so critical, because we are truly preventing the chronic homeless. Because we're not just giving them food and telling them we love them. We're literally walking them through the steps to understand and learn how to adult. That all those skills that are needed for us to truly be successful, whatever we consider success, right?
Sure. Yeah, and that the fact that we're affluent, you know, does mask the issue on some level, like you're speaking to. It also makes it really hard to find a place to rent a room for a reasonable cost. Like, affordable housing in Orange County is astronomical. So even as a, you know, having a full-time job with a wife,
you need two people with a full-time job to be able to pay rent.
Yeah. So that affluent nature actually works against a lot of these kids in trying to get their life back on track. They literally.
Well, don't get me wrong. I mean, Orange County has its rough areas, right? Like at the center in Anaheim, there's a lot of gang activity right around the center. At night, our kids share that they hear shots all the time, right? So that's up north, right?
Yeah, so I think that's another factor too, that people don't, they watch TV and they see shows that make Orange County look a certain way, and it has parts of Orange County that are like that, but it has parts that are completely the opposite of that too. You know, most people aren't driving through those neighborhoods to sightsee or go to the beach or whatever, but they do.
Or Disney, something as big as Disney.
Yeah.
And what's on the outskirts, right?
Mm-hmm.
What do you think?
Yeah, so if I'm listening to this right now and I'm driving on my car home from my job, and you know, you've given me a lot of really good information, Carlia, about the issue, but what can I do? I'm just a person. I have a good heart. I don't want kids to suffer, right? I want every kid to have his fair shake and get supported. So what can I do to help this issue?
You can call us, and it can be from a small donation to getting involved and doing more. The beautiful thing about the shift that we've had to make going virtual has opened a lot of opportunities for volunteers. And so that is something that is important for you to know, right? As a listener, if you were that listener, right? That there is an opportunity to help. You don't need to have $1,000. Oh, if you do, please go right ahead and donate it, and we'll make sure we use that properly to for it to go to programming. But, you know, every little helps. Walking these days helps, so I hear.
Yeah, right now we actually have a virtual run. Mm-hmm. This is whatever, this is going to get put out after the virtual run is over, unfortunately.
I know.
This would be a great plug. But yeah, so we have all kinds of special events that are always happening. So right now we've got a virtual run going on that we're asking people to get out there, run and walk to end youth homelessness, make a small donation to be a part of the fun.
$40, not a lot, is it?
Yeah, $40. And the finale is on July 18th, where we're getting everybody out to run and walk loud and proud. And we're doing it's a virtual thing, obviously, because we're in the COVID environment. But we're asking everybody to get on social media on that day and really share their walks and runs. Yeah, so there's all kinds of special events happening. We've got
so there's always something that can be done.
Yeah.
That's what the listener needs to understand.
Yes.
It's not a too big of a problem that I can't, it's too much for me. I can't handle it by myself. Yeah. No. It takes all of us coming together. So one person is the catalyst, right? To one youth. Think about it. The one mentor that one youth was that youth's catalyst in their lives. So that's all it takes. Just a little bit of love. That's it.
Yeah, we didn't mention the number, but approximately 30,000. There are approximately 30,000 at-risk and homeless youth in Orange County, ages 12 to 24, through the middle school, high schools, and college surveys that were done. So that's a rough estimate of the need that's out there. And you know, similar to what Carlia said, you can't save them all, but you can save one. So if each of us kind of has that mindset and we each, you know, do our small part, this problem that seems like this gigantic, insurmountable, impossible issue can be dealt with.
It's very doable.
Yeah.
And we do it every day.
We do it every day as an organization. So I want to thank you, Carlia. This is really nice. It was insightful. I appreciate you spending the time with us today. So take care.
It's a pleasure. All right.
Thank you for listening today to Listen Up, the Stand Up for Kids podcast. A big thank you to our production team consisting of associate producer Billy Quinn and editors Kariba Kauka, Pablo Ortega, and Michelle Bernay. Find us on Spotify, Google Play, iTunes, and wherever you get your podcasts. If you'd like to support Stand Up for Kids, please share this podcast with family, friends, and colleagues. Also, check out our website at standupforkids.org/Orange County, and you can email me directly at michaelo@standupforkids.org to learn more. Please also consider a donation to help getting kids off the streets. 95 cents out of every dollar donated goes directly to support our kids. I'm your host, Michael Olson, Director of Development at Stand Up for Kids Orange County. Thanks for listening and have a great day.